Hey, Brian Beeler here, and thanks for joining the Storage Review podcast. This week, we've got a fun guest, Patrick Kennedy from STH. Patrick and I have known each other for, probably close to a decade at this point, hitting the same trade shows over and over again and listening to the same pitches and dealing with all of that from a coverage standpoint and reviews and all that sort of thing. So wanted to have Patrick on. He's got an interesting take on the server market. That's where they spend a lot of their time. But we cover off on at least 10 minutes of talking about smoking meat. So if you're not into that, just sort of skip forward a little bit. But we do eventually get into tech, talk Intel, talk SMR, a little bit of storage, a little bit of event forecasting, all sorts of good stuff. So join me in welcoming Patrick. I think you guys are really going to like this. Joining us on the podcast today, my good friend, Patrick Kennedy from Serve the Home. Patrick, how are you?
Awesome. How are you doing, Brian?
I'm well. I appreciate you sending me a picture of yourself so I could see you again. That was very nice. It's been, I don't know, did we run into each other at all this year yet? It's all sort of blurring together. I don't know if we did something in January or February before this whole thing shut down.
I think maybe the last time I saw you was actually in Austin in November. That really cold, awesome barbecue adventure that we had.
Gosh, that was brutal. Yeah, that was it. And I think then I said we should do a podcast, and you're like, sure. And now it's July 1st when we record this. What took you 8 months?
Well, this is the first invitation I got, so.
So it's my fault?
I didn't say it. You did, but okay.
You know, it's funny. I don't know if you ever get this, but you and I know the hundreds of the same people, I'm sure. And I think sometimes people that don't know that we know each other think that we are arch enemies. But every time we end up at trade shows together, whether it was that that Dell thing or maybe VMworld before that or whatever, we end up hanging out and chit-chatting more than probably working in some cases. It's do you ever get that where people think, you know, oh, Patrick, he does servers, Storage Review, they do servers, they must be enemies?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we get that. I get that, I guess, with Storage Review. Another really interesting one is Dr. Ian Cutress at Anontech. People think that I don't know him and like he's been to my house and stuff like that. So it's very interesting. Like, you know, we go and see each other at all these events. I know that the two of us have shared quite a few adventures and quite a few beers, sometimes at the same time over the years. So it's really interesting. You know, it is a small community, I think, that gets to travel around, that does a lot of the coverage. I think everybody gets their own take. But at the same time, you know, we're at events in a normal year, probably at somewhere 20 to 40 events with each other, right?
Oh, yeah. Easy. Yeah, I remember, wasn't it Ian? We were at an Intel thing where you were buying him Nutter Butter donuts for some reason.
Krispy Kreme donuts. Yeah, I just thought, you know, he was flying in. So for those that don't know, Ian actually lives in London. So he's flying out to Santa Clara for an event. I think that was maybe the Optane memory event.
It was probably the very first one, not the real one where they actually released it. I think that was the first press conversation, though, was it?
I didn't say it wasn't real. I'm just saying I think it was the first exposure. And, you know, there, Ian was coming in from London, so I said, hey, I'm going to go get him something that is really American and bad for you. And so I just, you know, I live close to Intel's headquarters in Santa Clara, so I knew that there's a Starbucks right around the corner. Ran over to Starbucks, got my coffee, and then I was like, hey, wait a sec. I can make this an even better day for someone. And I went and got Krispy Kreme donuts because they had a couple fun ones that were absolutely terrible. And I thought it would be fun to get them for him. So,
and you know, what was his take on that?
I think he was less impressed with me than I was of myself.
I think that's pretty typical, though, for people that spend much time with you, don't you think?
Yeah, so I've learned that I now need to just set really low expectations so that way I don't disappoint folks and hopefully exceed.
I wonder, so it's probably not great podcast material, but we should maybe come up with a list sometime of of friends, and we might have some mutual enemies. I haven't really thought about that much, but we probably do, don't you think?
We have enemies?
I think so. If we have friends, we must have enemies. It's like that desk toy where the balls hit back and forth. The energy from one sends it out flying the other.
I would maybe say that we have some commenters with very interesting viewpoints, but I don't necessarily know enemies.
All right. I'll work on the enemies. You work on building up the friends. So with these tumultuous times, with no travel, I understand that you're probably filling your time with deep analytical reviews of servers, but I'm more interested in your barbecue extravaganza. I've seen your photos on Twitter. I did a pork shoulder this weekend. I think that's sort of the laziest, easy way out when you look at smoking. But what's been your latest smoking adventure?
Yikes! So I just got my second grill, or my second smoker, in 45 days. So it's escalating quickly, I would say.
So you just started smoking this summer?
Yes.
Huh. What got you started? I'm curious how you got into it.
Yeah. So it turns out that I love barbecue. And so, you know, we've actually had...
When did you discover that?
That was probably when I was a lot younger. But, you know, I love barbecue, number one. And I normally don't get to cook, right? Because we're always traveling. I mean, I'm on a plane on a normal year about once every 5 days. And even before I did STH, I did consulting, where it was basically the same gig. And so something that I just had as a thought was, I was like, hey, I'm home all the time now. What if I decided to learn how to make my own barbecue? And part of that is also that my favorite local barbecue place, we really can't get to because it's closed down. So anyway, not closed down, but it has takeout. Yeah, yeah. I support them whenever I can, but you know, there are limits. And so I said, okay, well, I wonder if I could make my own barbecue. And again, remember, I don't cook at all. And so I got into it and I said, let me go start smoking my own meats and maybe I can make my own barbecue. And so I went out and I went to Lowe's. I got my first smoker. It was a vertical smoker. It's like $400. Pit Boss mm-hmm. Pro 4 Series, I think, if you want to look it up. And anyway, so I bought my first smoker. I started buying some meat, threw it in there. I've been reading recipes online, watching videos. I've probably invested a insane amount of time learning this new skill, but I've been learning everything from the basics to I've been watching how to do competition cooks.
Oh, for crying out loud.
Yeah, I've kind of gone that way. And so, you know, I've been doing a lot of briskets. I've done pulled porks, a pork shoulder. My next one I think I'm going to try doing is the Hawaiian Kalua pork. So I went and found frozen banana leaves. You can't get tea leaves apparently, but you can get the banana leaves. And I think I'm going to try doing that soon. And so, you know, I've been doing tri-tip, which is a more of a California West Coast cut of beef, but it's very good.
Oh, I always do tri-tip on the grill. I think that's one of the most underappreciated cuts out there.
I think it is too, and you should definitely try my tri-tip one day. Next time you're in Santa Clara, maybe I'll make you one.
That would be delicious. Yeah, I started, as most people do, with the pork shoulder. I mean, it's dead simple, and I went... I know a lot of purists will get mad, but I went with an electric smoker. I just don't have the patience to manage the heat, and I just kind of want to... I throw it in usually at night, go to bed, wake up, and it's, you know, getting close to ready. And so I don't... I like the simplicity. Did you do electric on the second one, or what'd you do with your new smoker?
Yeah, so they're both actually pellet smokers.
Oh, you did pellet. Okay.
Which I think are awesome because you actually get the wood flavor. They're pretty easy. And, you know, the first one was that Pit Boss where it was a, you know, turn a dial. I think there's only like 25 degree increments in terms of temperature, but it's just a massive unit. And then the new one is Green Mountain Grills Jim Bui. And that one has things like Wi-Fi, so I can change my temperatures. Like I can be at Costco picking out meats and actually turn the grill on. I can monitor meat temperatures remotely, all that kind of stuff. So, you know, of course, this escalated quite quickly.
And I saw you did a brisket and some kebabs, and you're running like three or four things in there. It was crazy.
Oh,
I'm
yeah.
Like a one meat at a time kind of guy. I can't handle all that.
let's put it this way. I think my neighbors and family are very excited because I tend to cook way more than I can possibly eat. But I'm also, you know, looking up all these recipes and I just want to try them. So the easiest way for me to do that is just go get different cuts of meat, try different styles, put them all on at the same time, and then see what comes out. And I only want a little bit of each, so I just give all the rest away to everybody to know. And it turns out that you make a lot of friends doing that.
You can make a lot of friends doing that, but I tend to like to have the pork shoulder for lunch for another couple days, and I like a spicy rub on it, and then I'll make my own vinegar sauce. So I spent a couple of years in the Carolinas and became very fond of vinegar barbecue sauce, for lack of a better term. That's also handy because it's very low calorie, almost no calorie. So you still get that nice zing to it without having to sacrifice too much while you're indulging yourself in meats.
Well, I think we are just about to be unfriended.
Why? You're a barbecue sauce guy or no sauce at all?
Well, actually, with the ones I've been making, I haven't even been saucing it, but I tend to be, I do not like Carolina barbecue sauce. Just personal taste preference. I'm just not a big fan. So, yeah.
I'll get you like a jar of Stubbs or something just to hold you over. That's fine. So when you do the tri-tip isn't real fatty compared to like a brisket with that nice fat cap on top. How long do you cook that thing? And you ever worry about, do you get it dried out at all? What's the magic for tri-tip?
No, it comes out super juicy. It's only, it only takes somewhere in usually 2 to 3 hours. So they're pretty fast to go do. I've actually had my neighbors bring over tri-tips. They said, oh, well, you know, we know you might mess this up because you're new at it, but why don't you just give it a try because the last one was so good. So certainly, I think it's actually super easy to do in the smoker. Usually I do it at 225 because I'm cooking something else. This weekend I did 229 just because I wanted to do a non-5 increment.
Oh, Jiminy Christmas. What a nerd.
Well, you know, I just want to try it and just see how much smoke it has. But It's definitely pretty good, but the briskets are by far my favorite thing to cook.
Yeah, I'm just not a big brisket guy. I don't know.
I will make you brisket, and you're going to be amazed. I did a USDA Prime 14-pound brisket this weekend, and my next two are actually Imperial American Wagyu Reserve briskets.
Oh,
and so
look how fancy you are.
I told you, this has escalated very quickly.
So your brisket budget is in the planning for the rest of 2020. That's good.
Yep, totally.
So I'm sure this is really great podcast material for people that tune in for technical content.
Yeah, I think we're just talking about barbecue now. This is awesome.
I know. Now I'm hungry. It's you know, 1 out here in Ohio, and I am ready for barbecue. I'm actually just thinking about where I can go snag a sandwich without too much effort. We still have relative freedom in Ohio. I know you're locked down a little tighter, but how are things going over at STH? You guys, you know, getting access to product and good stuff, or what's your workflow looking like?
Yeah, workflow is certainly a little bit different with COVID. You know, I think there's part of it is our internal processes are a little different. Like for example, we can't necessarily get to the normal filming studio and product photo studio that we have. So that's been a little bit of a challenge. But, you know, I recognized that just before we went into lockdown in March. And so I managed to go grab all the stuff out of there. And we've been able to kind of make do, I think, with that. I think one of the bigger challenges, you're right, is working with companies, just getting products to review. You know, folks tend to be now on both vacation and they tend to be not in the office. So even getting simple things like products shipped for review is a lot harder. The data center still works great. So we have, you know, we do our reviews actually in a couple different data centers in the Valley. And so those are all operating normally, but it's still just a logistical challenge compared to what we normally have. And so, you know, I think it's working out okay though.
So you grabbed your equipment so you could keep doing your photos and videos. And I guess you're doing that at home now, or
yeah,
an undisclosed location?
No, 100%. So I literally took all of the furniture out of one of the rooms in our house.
Oh, your wife must be so happy with you.
No comment on that one.
You got real quiet there for a second. Okay, so yeah. you emptied a room in your house and filled it with a bunch of nerd gear.
Yeah, so, well, I mean, you know, we have, not. It's not really, you know, we don't actually have that many products. It's only one or two products there that we're taking photos of or whatever at a time. But it's really just having all the big lights and cameras. And, you know, I shoot on a certain camera. We have a different camera that we use for B-roll for the main camera when I do video. And I'm just very particular about our photography. So it's been a challenge, especially one of the actually really interesting things about that is we can't do product photos during the day because there are some higher up windows that reflect some weird light. Yeah. And in California, right, we have a house, but it's a lot, I would say, closer together than you would see in most Ohio developments, just because land in Mountain View is pretty expensive. So
people is that right? I've heard that it's not inexpensive to live in that area.
Yeah, and so, you know, we tend to have houses that are closer together, and so the house next to us actually emits a very orange light during the entire afternoon and for most of the day. So we have to wait until it's completely dark, and because it's summer, it's not dark until very late in the evening. And so we can only do photos and videos usually pretty late in the evening, which has totally changed my sleep schedule and stuff like that as well.
What about your drinking schedule? You can't get you can't throw back a couple and then do your hard-hitting videos, can you?
Yeah, so I would imagine I am a super lightweight at this point because
What about the blue door? Did you bring that from the office too, home?
Oh yeah.
Nice. That's nice. So
the only thing I couldn't bring was we have this just awesome table. So it's a adjustable workbench. Yeah. And I miss that thing every single day. I actually took the kitchen table and we're using that now because it was the strongest table I could get in the house. We're actually using that for product photography. So it's you know, using what we had, and it's just, this is what we have during the lockdown, right?
Yeah, well, you know, you deal with what you got, right?
What are you going to do? Yeah.
What are you going to do? So what are you guys excited about? I know you did some stuff on the third gen Xeon, sort of loosely calling it third gen. You're the server and CPU guy. What's your take on how that came out and what Intel's doing on the server side?
Yeah, so I think what Intel is doing on the server side is super interesting. So there was originally a Cooper Lake that was supposed to go in their next generation Whitley platform, which we're going to see in the Ice Lake generation later in 2021, according to current Intel plans.
Yes.
And so one of the interesting things I think about it is that Intel actually canceled that earlier this year. And they said, hey, we're not going to release that platform. And instead of doing that, what they did was they introduced the Cascade Lake refresh or second generation Intel Xeon Scalable. You see these SKUs usually have R's at the end of them. And the big deal there is that they drastically lowered the price per core that you tend to see on these SKUs. They also bumped up some clock speeds. And so they did a lot of stuff like that. One of the features that they took away, though, was the ability for those SKUs, especially the Xeon Gold series, to go into 4-socket configurations. So effectively, Intel was setting this up earlier this year. The third generation Intel Xeon Scalable launch is kind of like a modified Cascade Lake core, but it scales to 4 sockets and 8 sockets because Intel has actually increased the socket-to-socket communication links. So, you know, in terms of where you see this, I think that's a super exciting development now that Intel's really brought back the old Xeon E5, E7 bifurcation that we used to have in the market. They've really brought that back after unifying it under the original Xeon Scalable line.
So what do you think that does on the server side? So obviously we'll see those, or we already saw announcements from all the usual suspects or most of the usual suspects on dropping those in. I guess a couple platforms opted not. But at the same time, AMD is making good progress, and not just good progress, but they're enabling the systems guys that want to design for things like P PCIe Gen 4 SSDs, giving them an outlet there where it's still going to be a little while for Intel. What do you make of Intel versus AMD, interest in Gen 4? You have any takes on that?
Yeah, so this is the PCIe side, and you know, with NVMe storage, is actually really interesting. So a lot of people don't know this, but the hot swap capability for NVMe SSDs, I don't think happened until something like Broadwell or Haswell or one of those architectures. It actually wasn't originally working very well in Sandy Bridge and Ivy Bridge. So that would be Sandy Bridge is E5 V1, Ivy Bridge E5 V2, V3 is Haswell, V4 is Broadwell. And so it actually took the ecosystem a little while to be able to enable things like hot swap functionality on PCIe. So all of the devices that you see today were really using Intel Xeon CPUs for their PCIe Gen 3 development. And so when the AMD EPYC, the original Naples version, came out, which also is a PCIe Gen 3 part,
yep,
we tended to see a lot of those kind of nuanced bits that Intel was doing on their PCIe controllers. You really kind of saw that, well, the ecosystem really had designed for Intel. And so what's happening in the PCIe Gen 4 arena is now that Intel has said, hey, we're not going to have PCIe Gen 4 until late 2020, and in 2021, we're going to have Sapphire Rapids, which would be their next generation PCIe Gen 5 architecture. What the industry is really saying now is, well, if we want to have a PCIe Gen 4 ecosystem, we need to start it on AMD. So whereas the PCIe Gen 3 ecosystem was really built on Intel, we're seeing that the PCIe Gen 4 ecosystem of peripherals tends to be built on AMD because they get a much longer life where they can actually get these components out at PCIe Gen 4 speeds. So that is a huge market change that I think that, you know, doesn't get a lot of airtime, but it is a big impact to the ecosystem.
Well, if you want fast storage, it's the only play, right? I mean, you could do edge cards in an Intel box and come out okay, and there's some options for that. Liquid's got their Honey Badger, and Memblaze and others have add-in cards. But the add-in card form factor has really fallen off, you know, in terms of what the mainstream guys are doing. I don't think it's as much of a focus there. But Kioxia, as you know, dropped a couple new Gen 4 drives. We've got some from Hynix. They're coming. Samsung's announced them. But the platform support, so even though it's theoretically capable by AMD servers, most AMD server platforms did not redo the backplanes for the front drive. So even though the support's there, not many servers have actually enabled it. Lenovo is one that we have. It's one of the few. I don't know. You see more servers than I do. What do you see in there from backplane support?
Yeah, so it's not just actually the backplanes. So there's backplanes, which is one part of it, but then actually getting the PCIe Gen 4 signaling from the CPU or from server motherboard to the backplane, you need a lot better of a solution in terms of maintaining a lower signal. You need a lot better, signal quality. So what you actually see is that PCIe Gen 4 trace lengths on PCB tend to be much shorter unless you get more robust PCB, right? And so you have to use higher quality PCB. And so the other side to it is going up to backplanes, you also need a lot of times better cabling to be able to support that signaling. And so what's mm-hmm. happened is a lot of the server vendors have said, hey, you know, I understand that the AMD EPYC platform supports PCIe Gen 4, but do they really support PCIe, or is there support for peripherals that use PCIe Gen 4 such that I want to go spend the money enabling that on my system, right? So if I'm a system vendor and I can get PCIe Gen 4 for SSDs, but there are no PCIe Gen 4 SSDs, why would I ever make a system that supports it because it costs me more? And so that's a lot of the optimization that's going on right now. And I think that'll change over the next couple months, because right now, if you're a peripheral vendor, you can get PCIe Gen 4, but only on AMD, which still has relatively small market share compared to Intel. And so if you release a product now, you're really kind of going after that smaller market share. Versus as Intel starts to launch Ice Lake, we're going to see more and more vendors jump in with PCIe Gen 4 devices because there's a bigger ecosystem.
Well, yeah, that'll be the de facto standard. I feel it like it is a bit of a missed opportunity for AMD because they had, as you said, what, almost a year, really, of lead time on that. And the server vendors didn't jump on that. And, you know, like you said, part of it was the drives are just now getting out. And there are other products that can use PCIe Gen 4. Of course, our focus is mostly the hard drive or the SSDs and storage products. Yeah, it just feels like a little bit of a missed opportunity. But as I'm sure you have plenty of these conversations, a lot of the server guys are kind of stuck in the middle about how much do they really go invest in AMD platforms when at the end of the day, Intel's still the bread and butter.
Yeah, and that's actually why the cancellation of the Whitley Cooper Lake was important, because what you're seeing is that these server vendors, if you think about it, if I have a second generation Intel Xeon Scalable server out in the market today, there's a good chance that that server was released with Skylake, which was July 2017. So, you know, we're basically almost at the 3-year mark. And those OEMs are still selling those same servers pretty much until at least Ice Lake launches. And, you know, those platforms last beyond a new launch. But they're still, their current generation is what they designed 3 years ago, which means mm-hmm. that you can only get so much differentiation. So you've really seen, as Intel has changed their roadmap, I think the intensity of focus on the AMD solutions has definitely gone up just by virtue of a lot of these companies have designers that just didn't have any activity because these platforms got delayed.
Yeah, it's really, well, it's interesting. I think it's fun. And at the same time, it's also a little, you know, not sad, but, you know, it's cool to see the refreshes happening more often and more new stuff and more new design. And it'll be pretty slick to see what comes out with Ice Lake and from the mainstream guys and what's new there. So for all the servers that you guys are looking at lately, what does anything stand out to you? I know you've looked at, you know, some high density stuff in terms of storage and node density and messing around with little stuff for home lab and that sort of thing. But what's standing out to you lately in the team at STH?
Man, probably my favorite server that we've reviewed recently. Oh, this is tough. I would actually say we reviewed just before the NVIDIA A100 launch, we reviewed a SXM3 based NVIDIA V100 system with all the NV switch and all that kind of stuff. So mm-hmm. it had 8 GPUs, but it also had the really high speed fabric between the GPUs for AI training. And I think that system was really cool. You got to see some of the building blocks like the HGX2 baseboard that NVIDIA is using more now, and it's actually a big shift in the accelerator market that moved to those higher, I would say, higher feature set GPUs on NVIDIA PCB, and it changes the balance of power between the channel and the OEMs. So it's a very impactful change, and we got to see that just before that change went more widespread in the A100 generation. So I would say that would probably be my favorite, but it is a very close race.
I thought, it kind of surprises me because as cool as those boxes are, they're still pretty, I don't know if niche is the right word. Most orgs, the big ones anyway, are doing AI and all sorts of other next gen workloads. But I thought you were going to give me some big density story. I'm a little let down by your decision, honestly.
Well, that's a high-density GPU acceleration system. That's Why is that true. Not high-density?
That's true. I suppose so.
Let me give you the contrast to that. Yes.
Are you going to tell me your worst server?
No. But I'll tell you just a smaller spectrum side. So we reviewed a QNAP
yes.
box that I would call the Switch NAS server.
Switch NAS server, yes. I saw that.
And it was really, we actually just started internally calling it the Switch NAS server because I couldn't remember the model name. It's like QGD 1600-ish.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And QNAP's product names are difficult, right up there with Supermicro's, like QX4-999392-plus, whatever.
Yeah, and so this little box, there are definitely room for improvement. Let's say it's not a perfect box by any means, but just the concept of being able to put a NAS, a server, and a switch all in a single 1U platform, I really like the concept of it. The execution of it, I think, is good for its intended purpose. You know, it's a sub-$700 box. So in some ways, I kind of think of it, it costs about as much as a memory module. but, you know, the direction, especially for the SMB sector. So if you think of the HGP box as a very high-end unit, this would be a much lower-end, more accessible unit to folks. And I just really like the innovation there.
Well, QNAP's doing a lot of that, of course. So Synology and others. But QNAP and Synology have been, for the past probably like 2 or 3 years, really trying hard to nibble at that entry enterprise space. And they keep adding products. Synology's added a backup utility. QNAP's done the same thing, where they're really going after VM backup and really wanting to be the target for everything at an, you know, now we call it edge, but used to be robo or SMB, real SMB, where it can be your unstructured file shares for, you know, for your teams. It can be a target for your surveillance system. It can run certain applications. And actually, Kevin was messing around with some container work on a Synology, and there's a tremendous amount of flexibility there. I do wonder sometimes, though, if both of those guys could trim about 3/4 of their models and nobody would really know the difference.
Yeah, I think that market, just because they go for a higher volume, right, I think they have to get a little bit more nuanced in terms of how they delineate their products in terms of features. I do wish, actually, that they had a little bit higher-end CPUs in there. I think that's something that is an opportunity. But I actually went to the Synology show in New York City last year. And something that you notice just sitting there with those ecosystems and just talking to the people that are attending the shows, they tend to be either partners or customers of Synology. And there's a lot of SMBs, you know, whether that's a school or just a, you know, small business or whatever, that are using this because they say, hey, the cost of the solution is so much lower than going with a larger enterprise vendor that it's completely different scale. And the fact that these guys are building all of these features like backup, virtualization, all that into these boxes means that they can get a lot done without having to go and put together solutions from different vendors. So I think that, you know, the simplicity of the design, the overall software package, I think these guys are really doing a great job differentiating themselves.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've seen, I think it's a real issue, though, for the larger IT vendors to have solutions that can be priced effectively for those markets. And now with this push into edge being the new robo, a lot of guys are trying to do that. We're seeing some of the HCI groups like Scale Computing, who was already pitched as an inexpensive solution. They've got that one based on Intel NUX that they sell for, I don't know, something like $5,000. DataON's doing a little two-node converged solution with a zero-stack HCI. We're seeing other options come to market there, but I think you also highlight, you know, the point that in that price band, when you're looking at a couple grand up to, I don't know, $25,000 or whatever, there are so many choices that if you're an SMB, if you're a trusted partner, whether it's a reseller or a VAR or whatever, you really need someone to help navigate those options. There's just so much out there, and pretty easy to make some bad decisions if you don't invest the right way.
Yeah, and I, you know, the other side to it, as a interesting observation from sitting there, was these integration of the software and all of the functions that a business needs. So you talked about the surveillance, file sharing, backups, all that. I actually think that that is a big selling point. So when you look at bringing something like a VMware down to a SMB edge type deployment, that's really where there's a struggle, right? Because sure, you can have your virtualization solution, you can go put a backup solution on top of that, but what runs your cameras, right? Oh, you need to go see another vendor, right? So it's that, I think, bundling of a solution that those guys are doing a really good job at identifying a target market for and going after it. And I think a lot of the enterprise vendors, if they want to play in that space, are going to need to figure out a story around that and potentially go find a software solution, right?
Well, yeah, I just don't know. I don't know if they do, honestly. I don't get the sense that, you know, Dell, for instance, wants to go bundle a $15,000 or $20,000, you know, vSAN cluster or a rail cluster. And it's you know, the effort required there from a support and deployment standpoint probably make the metrics a little askew on that. So there is some room, though, for sure, for vendors to go figure something out. I think it just has to get easy. And that's not something historically the large vendors have been good at, to make it easy to go grab a resilient system with enough performance that can handle all the different workloads and just drop it off and go. So that's still a big challenge. So, speaking of NAS, I can't let this go because you've been doing a lot of work on it, on the red drives. And it's not just WD, but that's the primary drive that's under consideration here. What's the latest in your world on the SMR kerfuffle?
Yeah, so, you know, I think just a bit of background for anybody that hasn't seen this. So all of the hard drive vendors were found to have used DMSMR, or Drive Manager Device Manager SMR, technology in different product lines in hard drives without disclosing it. And so in about April timeframe, that got exposed, and the drive vendors correctly, I think, went in reverse course, and they actually said, hey, we're going to start disclosing whether or not we're using conventional magnetic recording or CMR technology or DMSMR technology. Now, Western Digital had something that was a little bit different, and they actually put the DMSMR technology into certain drives of their Red Series, which is designed for NAS. And they, when they released their new line of WD Red drives, they only did it actually in smaller capacities. So these are the 2 to 6 terabyte capacities, not the entire range. And the impact of that was, I think, a lot of the NAS vendors only in their validation matrices and what have you, only test maybe the larger new capacities instead of testing the full range. And if you just kind of think of,
yeah,
you know, how many permutations
that would be. I think
that's
pretty typical.
Right. Yeah. And this, I think everybody does it. But by not telling everyone that there was a big change in the drive technology and making sure that everybody was very aware of it, what ends up happening is nobody goes and puts those smaller drives into their test matrices. And so nobody notices that there are a couple drives that are completely different. And so what we did was we tested a case where we used a ZFS NAS, and we actually tried using a WD Red drive just to rebuild a existing CMR technology NAS. So idea here is you have a NAS that's full of drives. You go out, you have a drive fail, and you say, okay, well, I need to go get a drive. You go on Newegg, Amazon, you go out to Best Buy, wherever, go buy a WD Red drive, put it in. What happens? And what we found was that the performance of that rebuild was so bad that it was something like 9.5 days to do our rebuild, whereas the CMR drives, including the old WD Red drives, we're doing this, I think, at 4 terabyte capacity. The performance generally had been somewhere in the range of, say, 13 to 17 or 18 hours, somewhere in that general range. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you compare the idea of your RAID rebuild taking maybe a little over half a day to taking 9.5 days, that's a ginormous difference.
Well, it's not just a time difference, it's a data at risk difference, right? Depending on the NAS and your RAID configuration. But, you know, let's make it as simple as possible. A 2-bay NAS in RAID 1, you lose a drive, and now what? You're looking at 9 days that your data is at risk on a single drive. And if you don't know, I mean, that's scary. And people were rightfully aggravated by that.
Yeah, so we tested a 4-drive RAID Z, so RAID Z 1. So it's basically, think of it for folks that don't know ZFS, it would be something like a RAID 5 array, mm-hmm. where you have a single disk parity or single parity disk. And so that's what we used to test it. And it's the same idea, right? Whereas if you have a drive fail and it takes you a while, if there's an environmental reason or something like that your drive failed, you know, you'd be at risk to having another drive failure and losing your data during that 9.5-day period while the RAID rebuilds. And
yeah, not good. So WD restructured their red line, but SMR, even if it's on the label, it's still, well, I think it's problematic because not everyone even understands that technology implication, and expecting consumers to know that, which are more likely to be buying these small drives anyway. I don't know. It's still not great, do you think?
Yeah, so I completely agree with you. I think that there are folks, like, for example, I use the example of my dentist, right? I'd rather my dentist go read the latest journals in terms of technique rather than figuring out what SMR is, right? And so I think that that's a really good case where the first step is certainly doing that disclosure. The next question is, who has the responsibility to protect these users? Is it WD, making sure that they market drives for an appropriate use case? Or is it the users themselves that should be doing that research and we put the onus squarely on the users? And maybe the third one is, do we have to go look at the NAS vendors and say, hey, you should only support certain types of drives? Now, WD, to its credit, actually just last week, and I think this is going to go live and it'll still be last week, but they actually went out and said, hey, we're going to bifurcate the WD red line into red and red plus. Red mm-hmm. plus will be the traditional CMR technology. And there we're going to have, you know, kind of business as usual in terms of normal WD red capabilities. The WD red is going to turn into a DMSMR line. And so they clearly made that bifurcation. And so I think that's a good step in the right direction. And that's probably something that had they done a couple months or last year, that would have avoided a lot of this pain. But at the same time, now we just need to let folks know that if you are running a more intensive workload, if you're running ZFS, you shouldn't be using WD Red. You should be really looking at WD Red Plus. And, you know, in fact, we actually did something this Monday on that as an update. And I'm sorry, I just think we did it on Sunday, actually. But as an update to that, you know, the days are just totally
I know, we've
totally
all
gelling
lost,
now, right?
We've all lost track of calendars.
But, you know, one of the interesting things was we did 5 days after the announcement, we went and looked at the WD spec pages, and they still had WD Red with no mention of Red Plus or the different positioning. So not only would a consumer need to go and find the WD Red information and the DMSMR information, but they would also need to then read the WD blog, not just the mm-hmm. spec page, to realize that there were some different positioning going on. So I think that'll get fixed if it hasn't been already, but That I think is just, we have to do a good job of educating consumers so that way people don't buy the wrong drives for their use case. Now, there are other use cases where the WD Red is going to be perfectly fine and people can use them, no big deal, but we just need to make sure that education is happening.
Well, that was what all these guys did, though. Toshiba, Seagate, and WD, all in back, you know, there were more brands before the merger, HGST, they all said, okay, well, now we're going to do NAS drives. That's a thing. They exist now. They should be what you buy to put it into NAS systems. Of course, plenty of people put them into their PCs because in certain cases they were less expensive and, you know, it works fine in a PC, even though that's not the targeted environment. But when it says NAS on the label or red or whatever the association is with that workload, I don't know. It still just doesn't sit right asking consumers that buy these things to understand the difference. I don't really have that same feeling for larger deployments for enterprise. I mean, I think they're educated enough to know, do I want NVMe drives or is SAS okay? Do I want all flash or do I want hybrid? Like, those problems are better understood the higher end solution you get to. But I don't know. I just think these 5 bay and down kind of NAS scenarios, the drive should just work and the customer shouldn't be forced to go through a decision tree other than capacity and price on what they want to put in there.
Yeah. And I think you're highlighting a really great point there, which is, you know, there are people that just go to, literally will have a drive fail and just go to Best Buy and say, hey, well, I have WD Reds in my current NAS. I'm just going to go buy another WD Red, and they're not going to go do that research. So I think that is certainly a group of folks that will be vulnerable, right? Because if you're sitting there thinking about it, WD Red has worked fine. Why do I need a Red Plus? This right. has been fine for me for years, right? And so I think those people are especially vulnerable to this new naming scheme. And then the other one that we don't really focus on, since, you know, we're in the US, and I think we just don't, as in, you know, press, we don't do a good job really focusing on this, but there are a lot of places in the world that don't have access to the same technology and same electronics distribution that we have here. I'm in the Silicon Valley, so I can pretty much get any electronics part that I want. But if you are in, you know, certain countries, I mean, you can go to South America, Central America, even that close, and there are actually supply chains where you can't get a lot of different drives. There's also income disparity and, you know, all those types of things that limit your choices, right? Even regulations can limit your choices of what's available. So because of that, those folks may not have another option other than to buy a WD Red drive. And so it may not even just be an education gap. It may also be that this is the only option they have in their country or available to them to be able to buy.
Yeah, that's another interesting angle. And that's difficult. I think to your point about people auto buying what they have already, you know, in the old days with RAID, we were always beaten over the head of, that part number better sure as heck match whatever you have in there, or there's a good chance your RAID will fail, your rebuild won't work, or whatever. So like that messaging of decades of RAID management. Now in a NAS, it's less true, but you know, generally speaking, you like to match, you know, capacities and spindle speed if you can. But yeah, having one drive that's fundamentally different than the others in a group is, it's no bueno.
Well, you know that, but not everybody does.
I know. So that's a good point. We'll see what the vendors do. It wouldn't be so hard for Synology and QNAP at least to identify the drive as different, would it?
Yeah, but if they did that, then they would, it would be after the purchase, right? So if I purchase a drive and I put it in my system and it identifies it as something different, that would be that's not the ideal, right? Ideally, you'd want that information to be before the point of sale so people get into that, right?
But better to know and be able to respond with, you know, return or just saying, you know what, for this workload, it's fine and I'll deal with it. But yeah, we'll have to see what the NAS guys do. I'd like to think they'll do something to at least provide some more information and awareness to people that have these systems.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're doing a great job of starting that process, but I think there's still work to go.
All right, so let's end on an up note. When are we traveling again? When are we going to run into each other at a trade show or an event or a covert dinner somewhere?
Or Jungle Gyms in
or Jungle Gyms. Yeah, I know you've been talking about that. Now we've had to pause that by several months. Jungle Gyms, for those that are unaware, is we've got two of them actually in Cincinnati. It's a giant international grocery store where if you're barbecuing even, you need a specific spice or herb or something. They will have it for sure, regardless of where it lives. So you talk about in Silicon Valley being able to find any computer part. I can find you any culinary part that you could require at these stores. And they've got a tremendous beer selection, cheeses, salsa, anything you could want. It's fantastic.
Well, I can't wait to make an adventure trip one day to Jungle Jim's.
We will do that. I have heard as recently as maybe about 3 or 4 weeks ago, rumblings of a formal get together in October. I don't know if it'll happen. Have you heard anything at all? I'm sure the people in your area are maybe a little more apprehensive about travel than we are in the Midwest.
I am guessing that it's going to be sometime in 2021 that we're going to travel again.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So lots of time to continue perfecting my barbecue arts.
Will you be able to? So when I come to California, you'll bring me something. If we meet in Las Vegas, I fully expect you to figure out a way to package and deliver that while still keeping it warm.
The TSA is going to love me, I think, is the answer on that one.
Sir, you're going to need to remove the lid on that Pyrex container, and then that smoky goodness just wafts all through the security line.
Probably have to bring two briskets, one that'll have to get confiscated at TSA and one hopefully for you. So,
oh man, that would be fantastic. All right, I'm looking forward to it, buddy. Good conversation today. I think this was fun. I think, sometimes our listeners like to hear some of the what goes into the sausage making, even though we talked about meat for the first 15 minutes. But yeah, I enjoyed it. Thanks for jumping on, and let's not leave it to be 8 months between these things.
Definitely. Thanks for having me, and have an awesome day, man.
All right. Thanks again to Patrick for joining us today. Great conversation. I'll make sure we get Patrick on a more regular basis. We get a lot of feedback from you guys that you like these sorts of communications, these sorts of podcasts where we're just sort of talking shop and showing how things work. So we'll do that again soon. If you've got a suggestion, hit us up at info@storagereview.com. Find us on LinkedIn, on Instagram, we're everywhere. I'm not going to say TikTok, but you might be surprised if you poke around on some of those social media sites and see what we've got going on. So thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next week.